Welcome to the Trace Evidence Holiday Q&A, where I'll be answering listener questions. I always look forward to doing these Q&As, and I'm excited to see what you have in store for me. For those of you who have been asking, regular episodes of Trace Evidence will return on Monday, January 7th, and we'll be back on the weekly schedule at that time. I want to thank all of you for your patience and for reaching out to me during this holiday break that I'm on. Just one final note before getting to your questions. Stick around after the questions for a few details about Trace Evidence going forward and my plans for the show in 2019. Now, let's get to your questions. Colin Connolly asks, are you a fan of Twin Peaks? Your background music is eerily similar to the music used in this series. No, I'm not actually. I've never seen a single episode of Twin Peaks. The background music was just something I wanted, background music for the show that wasn't too invasive and was just kind of back there and a little eerie, but I didn't want it to overcome everything. I haven't checked out Twin Peaks. A lot of people I know have told me it's the kind of show I would enjoy, so it's something I plan to look into in the future. Michelle Sears asks, you do such an amazing job on all the research for each story. Have you ever had to abandon a topic because the details were just too disturbing or gruesome for you to handle? No, I haven't touched on any. Usually if I come across a case and I find the details really disturbing and I found the case itself gruesome or whatever happened gruesome, I take that sort of as motivation to cover it more because what happened was so horrifying. Usually what I'll do in those situations is I just won't give you all of the brutal details. It may be necessary to the story to tell you that a victim was stabbed 13 times. You don't need me to give you the intricate detail of each one of those stabs and how it went and, you know, go through a really bloody, gory explanation of it. So, no, I haven't come across any that were too gruesome or disturbing for me. And if anything, I take those cases and give them more importance. Nick Lodahl asks, have you been following the Jamie Kloss case out of Butler, Wisconsin? What is your theory? I have been paying attention to it, and I'm keeping track of news articles, and I have a file going on it at the moment. I'm just watching to see if more develops, but you will likely hear my theory when I cover that case. I don't want to give it right now because I don't feel that I have enough information to have a solid theory yet, but that's a case that I more than likely will address. So, you know, you won't have to wait too long for me to tell you my theory on that one. Devin Williams asks, what made you decide to start a podcast, and do you have any experience in the criminal justice field? I decided to start a podcast because I was listening to a lot of podcasts. I've always been sort of obsessive about true crime, and so I wanted to do something with that. And the people in my life, I think, were getting really tired of listening to me explain cases and unsolved stories to them before. So I started listening to a lot of true crime podcasts, and while there's a lot of great ones out there that I still listen to and enjoy, there were aspects of it that were missing. And I'm someone who is really, really into detail. So I felt like rather than complain or say, hey, what can you give me more detail or look into the cases, I decided I'll just do a show the way I would want it done and I'll give as much detail as possible. So I tried to take something negative and turn it into a positive. As for whether or not I have any criminal justice experience, I took some criminal justice courses in college. I took forensic psychology in college. So I did do a little bit, but really not a lot. There was a period of time in my life where I was considering trying to become a police officer. And I ended up putting that to the side because I became a lot more fascinated in psychology. And that's really what I followed in college, psychology and history. So, a very minimal experience in criminal justice. I really don't want to build it up to be more than it is because I don't want to say anything that would insult people who actually make a career out of this and know their stuff when it comes to criminal justice. This one comes from someone who didn't leave their name. Completely random question. What is your middle name? What are your hobbies? My middle name is Paul. It's my father's name. As for hobbies, I'm really into movies. I collect movies. I have tons of movies here. I love movie analysis, so I love watching films and then really getting into the analysis of what was going on and the subtleties and the all that stuff, especially when you look at really old school movies, 1930s and 40s. There was so much going on between the lines in those movies, so there's a lot to examine there. Beyond that, I love history, so I read a lot of history books. I watch a lot of shows about history. Other than that, mostly my normal hobbies. I play video games here and there, but I don't really have time to do it too much. And I write. I write for this show, obviously, but I also write in my free time. I write a lot of poetry and short stories. I have multiple novels that I have written out and mapped out on index cards, and I have notebooks full of writing. So hopefully one day I'll get back to that, too. Louise Hughes from the United Kingdom asks, have any families of the cases you've featured been in touch, and were they pleased or did they get angry at anything you said? My experience with the families has been really positive. Almost every family member that's ever reached out to me has been positive and has been appreciative of me touching on the case and covering it. I've only had one family that not only was upset that I did the case, but they didn't want me to discuss anything about it. Like, they emailed me and were pretty angry that I did it at all and felt like I should have asked their permission to do it, which I'm not going to say which case it is, but I kind of had my mind blown by that because most people want attention on the cases. So, I've only had one negative experience with that, which I was able to communicate with them and work something out and keep the episode up. I haven't had anybody request me to remove an episode yet, and I'm really not sure what I would do if it came down to a family member specifically saying, we want you to remove that episode. Part of me would feel like I should remove it out of respect for the family, but another part of me would feel like the case deserves attention. So hopefully that's a bridge I never have to cross. But yes, most of my experiences have been very positive. Alex Wilson asks, what do you do for work? Do your coworkers know that you have a true crime podcast? Work-wise, I work in operations. It's not as exciting as it sounds. It's actually really boring, but essentially I work for a large company and I'm involved in part of the process of making sure the work's getting done the way that it's supposed to be getting done and that everything's orderly and on time. In terms of whether or not my coworkers know I have a podcast, they do. Some of them talk to me about it and recommend cases. Others don't know what a podcast is. So you get kind of a mixed bag on it. Some people will at work come up to me and say, hey, what do you know about this case? What do you know about that case? Other people, you get the what's a podcast? And then you're trying to explain to them what a podcast is, but more questions just keep coming, like, well, what's iTunes? What's an iPod? You know, that kind of stuff. But yes, my coworkers are aware, and for the most part, they're supportive on it. It's sort of like my family. They get the idea of what a podcast is, and they've listened to it. But in terms of how it's made and why I do it, I think they have a little bit of confusion there. And it's just like, okay, well, we'll just trust that you know what you're doing. Nicole Prince asks, will you do an update about the Unique Harris case? I thought I read that there was an arrest. I've been trying to do an update on this case, but the information simply isn't there yet. Family members of Unique posted on social media that there was a suspect who was in custody and they were pretty sure that this person had done it, but they didn't know if they would be able to prove it. And it kind of gave the impression that there was more information there than we were aware of. This person they believed was connected to it. Law enforcement believed this person was connected to it. When I saw that, I shared those posts on social media. I was very excited about it. I was hoping we were going to get a break, but the wheels of justice can move slow. Law and order can take longer than you want it to. So until I find out more information, there's nothing to update yet. All I know is that it's possible an arrest was made, but no press conferences have happened. There's been no public statements by the police. And outside of that posting from a family member, there's been no updates. But I assure you, if that case breaks, if there's new updates, I will release an update episode. The next question comes from Kaisetta Johnson, and I apologize if I butchered your name. Will you record more two-in-one episodes of short cases? I did that once, way back in the beginning of the show. I had initially decided that if I didn't have enough information for a full-length episode on a case, that I would do more than one case per episode. But honestly, it wasn't received very well. I don't think people enjoyed having the two cases, because with the format of my show, basically, I would give you all the evidence on one case, then all the theories, then all the evidence on another case, then all the theories. I think it was a little confusing. The two cases I did it with are interesting cases, and at this point in time, I could probably do full-length episodes on each of those cases, but Maybe in the future, if I ended up in a situation where there were multiple cases people really wanted covered, but there just wasn't enough information, but I have been actively avoiding doing more than one case per episode. Saranyi asks, what does your family think about trace evidence? Are they supportive? Do they think that you're obsessed with true crime? My family is very supportive. My mom listens to every episode. My brother listens. I have sent, you know, t-shirts and stickers to family members. I have some cousins that listen. I have in-laws that listen. The family's been very supportive of it. I haven't gotten any negative feedback from anybody. My father, being the way that he is, initially wanted me to use a fake name when I did the show, but I felt that that would hurt my credibility as being factual if I was using a fake name, even though a lot of true crime podcasters out there use fake names. They're very supportive. They don't think I'm true crime obsessed. Then again, I'm obsessive about a lot of things, so they might just be used to that. Angie asks, do you ever sleuth any of the cases that you feature? I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that. I do look into a lot of reports, as much information as I can get on the cases. I haven't gone to a location and personally interviewed people and done detective work. I really can't afford to travel around the country like that at this point in time, but I get as much information as I can from as many sources as I possibly can. I do have a case currently in process that I'm hoping to release in February, where it's local to me, and I have done a lot of local investigation related to this case. So that'll really be the first instance where I'm boots on the ground when it comes to a case and really digging into it beyond what I normally do. This question is anonymous, and it asks, other than true crime or Tolkien, what's a good book suggestion? I read a lot of different books. I'm sort of all over the place when it comes to books. Sometimes I like to sit down and read a really engrossing historical biography. And other times I'll sit down with like a coming of age teen novel and read that. So it really depends what I'm in the mood for at the time. But if I was going to recommend a book or two that I personally enjoy a lot, The Catcher in the Rye has always been a favorite book of mine. What I find fascinating about that book is it revolves so much around the idea of not growing up and staying locked in that childlike mentality. And I actually seem to believe when I've gone back and read it that I think that's a book you can really only connect with when you are a certain age. The older I get, the less I enjoy the book. And I think that's kind of sad, but I think that's sort of what the book is doing in that way. The older I get, the more I look at Holden Caulfield, the main character, and just question what he's doing and why he's doing it. Whereas when I was 15 or 16 and reading that, I totally got everything that he was doing. So Catcher in the Rye is always a book that I'll recommend to anybody. Beyond The Catcher in the Rye, I read this really great biography about Emily Dickinson, who is my favorite poet. It's called My Wars Are Laid Away in Books. That's a really, really good read. It's really fascinating. You learn so much about her that people today don't realize. She's a fascinating character in general because she was so ahead of her time. And today, a lot of people aren't aware of who Emily Dickinson was. They may have heard a poem here and there, but to read her life story is really engrossing. Diana Yanishevsky asks, I was wondering, do you have kids? Because the crimes that involve kids seem to bother you as much as they do me, and I have 7 children, and my second grandchild is on the way. Well, congratulations on your second grandchild. I do not have any children. I dated a woman for a long time who had 2 children, and I was close with them, but I don't personally have children. I think the crimes that involve children bother me so much because children are innocent. They can't defend themselves. They don't deserve when these terrible things happen to them. And for me, someone who would harm a child, commit a crime against a child, murder a child, is really the lowest form of life on the planet. There's a lot of terrible people out there, but to do something to a child is just so horrifying. I can't even conceive of how someone could do that. So I think it's just a matter of the contrast of the innocence of a child against the horror and brutality of the things that are done to them, sadly. Pam Fitz asks, if money were no object and you could go anywhere to investigate a case, where would you go and what case would you look at? My initial thought, the one that was on the top of my head, was I would want to go to California and examine the Zodiac Killer case. It's a case that's always fascinated me. The problem with that is I really don't think there's anything I could add to it. I know there's always podcasts coming out about it. It's a go-to case for a lot of people because a lot of people are fascinated by it. But with as much as I've read on that case, which as much as I've studied on that case, I have yet to listen to a single podcast cover the Zodiac case where I didn't know everything that they said already. So unless I could add something to that case, I don't know that it would be worthwhile. But yeah, my initial thought was California Zodiac Killer. It also helps that I enjoy California. Given how old the case is, I really don't know how much information there would be to dig up at this point in time either, so. Tunya Elzinga, whose name I am sure I butchered, asks, I just wanted to say, keep up with the great work you do. Love listening to your show. Well, thank you. Maybe this is a weird question, but I watch a lot of shows, and I always wondered why in America they get prison sentences 200 years, 100 years, 200 to life, etc. Why is it like that? I'd like to hear your take on it. It's not that I disagree with it. I just find it kind of odd because nobody lives that long. I know in Holland, the most you'll ever probably spend in prison no matter what you did is 25 years. Well, I'm not an expert on the legalities of all that because from state to state, you've got different laws and different prerequisites for crimes and how long you have to serve based on what you did. But a lot of the times it has to do with how many things they're charged with, whether the terms are going to be served concurrently, things of that nature. And I think there are certain rules in place so that you can't give somebody a certain amount of time beyond what they're supposed to get for specific kinds of crimes. And some of those obviously need to be adjusted, but that's more of a political argument. But yeah, I think it's just a matter of we're dealing with a lot of laws and a lot of rules that have been in place for a long time and probably need to be updated a little bit. On the other hand, if someone commits a terrible crime and they're given a 200-year sentence, I'm completely in favor of that, and I have no problem with people spending the rest of their lives in prison if they deprive someone else of their life or their ability to be happy or to live a normal life. Diane Dyson, a Patreon producer, asks, Hi, Stephen. What is the one case you would like to be solved, and what is the one case that haunts you? It's always difficult to pick one case for these because I would like to see all of these cases solved. The first case that occurred to me today was the disappearance of Lily Aramburo, which I covered, I believe, in episode 41. And that's a case where all the information is there, and it's just a matter of putting it together. And why that case isn't solved blows my mind. It seems pretty obvious what happened there. Unfortunately, if you don't have the evidence, it's very difficult to make that connection. But that is a case I would love to see solved. In terms of a case that haunts me, the murder of Candace Hiltz haunts me quite a bit. I still find that to be one of the more disturbing cases I've ever covered. Candace's age and the way that she died combined with what was going on with the police over there and the corruption that was involved. That case just, it really drives me crazy. So until the answers come out for that case, it will probably always haunt me. And having been in touch with some of Candace's family, it's just heartbreaking. That entire story and everything that happened there is just tragic. And the answers should have been found by now. Donna asks, other than true crime related, what else would you like to host a podcast about? Well, I have another podcast in development at the moment that I've been working on writing off and on. It's a little difficult to write it because the workload for Trace Evidence is so heavy, but it will be a history-based podcast, so I would love to do that. Beyond that, I'd love to do a podcast where I don't have to write a single word, just something off the cuff where we're reviewing a movie or talking about a show, or something where I can just talk back and forth, have a good time, laugh every once in a while. You know, it's amazing. People in my personal life know that I'm constantly joking around. I can be funny. I enjoy funny situations and lighthearted things. But when you listen to Trace Evidence, I give off very much the impression of seriousness and somberness. I think that's necessary for the subject matter, but I would like to be able to do a show that shows the other side of me as well. Rachel Proctor asks, what made you decide, I'm going to start this podcasting thing and see how it goes? In a connected question, Karen Sweat asks, what inspired you to begin producing your podcast? Mostly that I was listening to a lot of podcasts, and while they were good and entertaining and fascinating, and I have nothing negative to say about them, there were aspects of them that I would have done differently. So when I would listen to a show and they didn't give enough detail or they didn't go enough into this area, or if I'm listening to the show and asking questions to myself and those questions never get answered during the show, it bothers me. So it was more or less a matter of I had two options: leave reviews or contact these podcasters and say, hey, can you do it like this, or do it myself. So I decided I'll just do it myself, because what's the point of contributing to the negativity? If a show is good, but it didn't do it exactly the way I would do it, that doesn't mean I should leave it a 2-star review, or I should send an email saying, why don't you do it the way I would do it? I figured I'll put my money where my mouth is, and I'll just do it the way that I want to do it. So really, that was the driving force, just listening to podcasts, enjoying them, but wanting a little bit more, and deciding, all right, since no one's doing it the way I want it done, I'll do it the way I want it done. We're about halfway through the questions at this point, so we'll get right back to them after a quick word from a sponsor. And now, back to your questions. Next question comes from Jennifer Winkler. Out of all the cases you have covered in which someone has disappeared, which case do you think has the strongest potential for the person to still be alive and located? I thought about this question a lot before I answered it, and I don't want to be negative and I don't want to be cynical. But honestly, I couldn't think of a single case I've covered where I felt like this person who disappeared is probably still alive. There's some potential for someone to still be alive connected to some of the cases that I've done, but I feel like the more years pass, the longer time since the disappearance, the less likely it is that someone is going to be found alive. I would love for some of these people to be found. I just don't think it's likely. So unfortunately, I don't want to give you a name, because I don't want to lend that onto any of these cases when I honestly don't feel that the likelihood is high enough for me to give you a case name. Samantha Siebert writes in and asks, is there a case you feel strongly that you know what has happened to the individual, or a case that you feel will be solved in the near future? There are cases where I have a pretty good idea of what I believe happened. But I'm very big on not telling you what I think happened. Even when I cover the theories on the cases, sometimes one of those theories is mine, but I don't tell you that it is because I don't want to influence your thoughts on that case in any way. I am not an expert investigator. I'm not a member of law enforcement. So I don't ever want to step out there into a case and say, here's what I think happened, as though I'm some expert. I think that's insulting to law enforcement, and I think it's insulting to the family. So it's probably something that you're never going to hear me say, but there are certainly cases where I have a pretty good idea of what I think happened. In terms of a case that I think is going to be solved in the near future, there's been a lot of news lately around Rachel Cook, which was the episode 64 of Trace Evidence. The law enforcement has said they're digging in a new place based on a tip, and they're specifically looking for Rachel. So I'm hoping that the answers in terms of Rachel are coming soon. Claire Bailey asks, as an English listener, have you ever considered doing a case from the United Kingdom? That's actually part of my plan going forward in 2019, is I would like to do some more cases from around the world. I get requests for cases in other countries a lot. Usually, if I don't cover them, it's because it's harder for me to get information on those cases. But I do plan in 2019 to try and get more out there into the world sphere. I have not covered a lot of foreign cases, or at least outside the United States cases, but I would really like to do that. So I'm hoping in 2019, you're going to see a lot more cases from all around the world. Kay Walters, also from the UK, asks, have you heard of the Jean-Claude Roman case from France? It's fascinating. Imposter murders are the most interesting cases to me. She also asks, what sort of cases fascinate me the most? In terms of the Jean-Claude case, I haven't heard about it, but I'll take a look. And as I was saying in my previous answer, I want to do more cases from around the world. So a French case is certainly one that I'd be willing to look into. So I'll add that to my list and see what I can find. In terms of what cases fascinate me the most, disappearances do, but specifically mass disappearances. So two or more people disappearing at the same time. It's just mind-blowing to me. When it comes to one person disappearing, that's confusing and disturbing enough as it is. But a group of people disappearing, it sort of defies explanation to me. So yeah, mass disappearances, cases like the Fort Worth 3, the Springfield 3, the Colorado triple murder that I covered, those just blow my mind. The idea that as humans, we feel there's safety in numbers, but cases like that remind you that that's not always true. Next question from Becky Kleins is, do you ever interview friends or family of the subjects in your research? Or is the story you tell comprised wholly of information gathered from various websites or forums? I have spoken to family members about cases, Usually what I do is I do all of my research and I write my script first, then I reach out to them. As much as you want to get information from a family member, I try and get background primarily. I don't like to ask them about the crime for several reasons. One is that I don't want to upset them. It's very difficult. These are horrible things that have happened. Some people are okay talking about them. Some people would rather not. So you have to be kind of delicate in that area. Another reason is because no matter who you are, if you're connected to that crime in any way, if it was a family member or friend, you're going to have an opinion. You're going to have a bias. So I like to get all my facts laid out before I speak to a family member or a friend, and mostly I'll ask them for background information or to clarify details that I find a little confusing. So I don't do it a lot, and when I first did the show, I had a strict rule for myself, which was I wasn't going to do it at all because I just wanted to be the facts that I could find. As time's gone on, I've found that it's more important to speak to them, even if I don't include a single thing that they've said on the episode, to get their opinion. And I really would love to do interviews with these people for separate releases. I've always thought about interviewing people and releasing it on Patreon or in some different form, just as background to the case. And that's something that I'm currently working on for 2019. I've been in touch with a couple of family members of cases I've done in the past, and I'm trying to arrange to do interviews with them for later releases as follow-ups on those cases. Alicia asks, "Hi, I'm slowly working my way through your backlog, and I'm actually listening to your first Q&A episode, and you answered someone's question by saying there's a case you want to cover, but others who have tried it have been threatened, doxxed, etc., so you were holding off. Have you changed your mind on this?" I wouldn't say I've changed my mind on it in so much as I'm at a point where, whatever, threaten me and dox me, I don't care. Early on in the show, I was very concerned about those kinds of things. I didn't want to get a bunch of threats. I didn't want someone to expose my information. But the more I do it, the more I feel like, if you want to do that, do that. I don't care. I'll cover whatever I want to cover. If someone's going to threaten me, if someone's going to dox me, it's going to happen whether I want it to or not. And at some point in time, I'm going to cover a case that's going to upset somebody enough to do one of those things. So that is a case that I probably am going to do in 2019, and whatever happens, happens following up with it. Alicia also says, "I was thrilled to hear that you want to do a JFK episode. That is by far my pet case, and I love hearing about it and discussing it." The JFK assassination is a case that I have been fascinated with since I was a child. I've read countless books, watched documentaries, movies, everything I could get my hands on about this case I've looked at. It is so far-reaching and extensive when you're looking at just the theories alone. When you look at the facts of what was going on in the White House at that time, in the country at that time, there is so much information out there that if I did a JFK episode, this thing would be like 15 parts. So what I've actually done with the JFK episode that I want to do is I've sort of moved it to the side. And I mentioned earlier that I was going to do a podcast that's history-based. It's probably going to move into that. So whereas I may at some point do a case that touches on JFK, like when I did Dorothy Kilgallen, I don't think you're going to see a Trace Evidence JFK episode unless I do it like as a Patreon exclusive or I spit it out into the other history podcast that I'm working on. This next question is from Jessica Potilla. "Here's a question I've thought about many times in my life. Why do you think people do these horrible things to one another? Do you think it's some sort of defect in the brain, like a mental illness or chemical imbalance we have yet to discover? It's not just like one person has been kidnapped and murdered. It happens all the time and has throughout recorded history. I guess I'm referring specifically to serial killers with this question, as people have plenty of motives for murder, but the serial killings just make no sense to me. Not that any murder is justifiable, but why do people feel compelled to murder complete strangers? You could say some are sociopaths, but not all sociopaths are serial killers. I just don't get it." That's a really complicated question with an answer that I am not in possession of. I think it's probably a mixture of a lot of different things. So you have people who are born sociopaths or psychopaths. You have people that become sociopaths or psychopaths. I think it's psychology would say it's the whole nature versus nurture. I think it's a mixture of the two. I think sometimes there is no explanation for it. But unfortunately, when you look at human history and the atrocities that we've committed against one another over the years, it's sad to say, but violence against one another seems to be a trait of humans. It's something that we do. It's something that I think everybody is capable of. Some people have control. Some people have a good filter. Some people have a grasp and have a conscience and have feelings and aren't going to do those things. And some people don't. And then you have the people in between who have all the reasons not to do it, but in a moment of passion or whatever, they make the terrible choice to commit the crime. So that's a really, really complicated answer that I hope one day is found, but I honestly don't believe we're ever going to know what causes people to be this way. I think it's far too complex of an answer. Debbie Savigliano asks, Steven, your best guess, what happened to Maura Murray? I got asked about the Maura Murray case more than almost any other case that exists in the world of true crime, and I understand people's fascination with it. It's a sad story. It's got a lot of different things going on in it. The theories around that case have expanded out almost to a JFK-sized complexity. I don't think the case is as complicated as people make it out to be. I'm probably not going to tell you what I think exactly because I really don't want to deal with the backlash on it. But what I can say is I don't believe a lot of the far-fetched theories that Maura's still out there somewhere and went through this complicated thing to conceal her identity and move somewhere else and start a new life. I simply don't believe that. I believe Maura Murray is deceased. I believe that the answers will eventually be found. I know there was some news lately about them digging and looking for a body. I think that's what's going to end up happening at some point. It's going to be found. Maura's going to be found. And it's either going to be a case of she was murdered or she died of exposure. But I don't believe the really complicated conspiracy theories revolving around that case. Rebecca Claussen asks, of all the cases you have covered, which would you solve if you were given the chance? I really can't pick one. I would love to see them all solved. I think depending on what day you ask me that question, my answer is always going to be different with whatever case is in my mind at the moment you ask. At the moment, the case that came to mind was Candace Hiltz. I would love to see that case solved. I would love to see answers for that family. But really every case I've ever covered is a case that I want to see answers for. If I could solve them all, I would. If they could all be solved, that would be amazing. Unfortunately, it's unlikely, but with all the stuff that's going on right now with the advancements of forensics and the whole DNA thing, you're seeing a lot more cases solved that people didn't think were ever going to be solved. So that gives me hope for the future. So I know it's kind of a cop-out answer, but all of them. I want to see all of them solved. The next question comes from Mike Morford, or as many of you know him, Morph, the host of Criminology, Murder in My Family, Crime Sphere, and I think like 27 other podcasts. I have no idea how he had the time to ask me a question because he's constantly in production on podcast episodes. However, jumping into his question, are there any cases you feel are too big to take on but you'd really like to? Zodiac, probably. I know Mike has done this case, but I feel to do it the way I would want to do it with the detail that I would want to go into, it would be like a 40-part, hour-long episodes. I mean, I could go on that case. I could probably do a year's worth of podcasts on it. Just looking into all the side theories on it, there would be so much to cover there. Jack the Ripper is another one. A lot of people have asked me to do the Jack the Ripper case, and I would love to, but I also sort of feel like, what could I really add to it? There's been so much speculation there. I don't know that that case is ever going to be fully solved. It would be interesting to cover, but I don't really like to do cases unless I feel like I can add something to them. Morph also asks, what are the challenges for you putting out the podcast? Mostly just the time consumption, which I don't have to explain to you, but it takes a lot of time to do an episode. It's not a matter of, let me sit down and write this script and record it and do it all in one day. The research is several days. The writing of the script is several days. The recording is usually a day, but it depends how my voice is that day, how my throat is that day. It can take me anywhere between 5 and 12 hours to record an episode. Then you got to edit it. You have to put it out there. There's all the social media that goes along with it. I got to tweet about it, Instagram, Facebook. There's so much involved with doing an episode. So it's really just a matter of the time consumption. And I work a regular job. So I go to work, I come home, I do more work for the show. It's just very time consuming. That's really the number one challenge for me. His final question is, if you had to pick one and only one Halloween film to watch, which would it be? It would be the original, which is the greatest Halloween film in the entire franchise. The Halloween film franchise is something that I really enjoy. I've loved it since I was a kid. I think the first one is an incredibly well-done movie that unfortunately subsequent sequels were subjected to the fact that slashers were on the rise in the 80s and the Halloween films became slasher films. Whereas if you watch the original Halloween, there's very, very little blood on the screen. There's only like four murders that actually take place. And it's a lot more of a suspense and a thriller film than it is your conventional horror or slasher film. Charlotte Kent asks, have you encountered issues when researching a case, either with protected, limited information or being harassed, threatened by people involved? Do you think you've read or seen files you shouldn't have? I haven't really had too many issues with that. Sometimes there's information that just simply they won't give to me, whether it be a police department, a family member, whatever the case may be. So sometimes I deal with limited information, but I find a way around it. In the age of the internet that we have, when you come across a case and you can't really find anything about it, that's kind of rare. There's a few cases I've looked at where the information's limited, but there's always something that you can find. And if you dig enough, you can find more. In terms of reading or seeing files that I shouldn't have, I don't think so. It's rare that someone's going to make the mistake of giving me information that I shouldn't have. I know on one of the cases I'm currently working on, I had some discussion with people who were close to the case, and they gave me information about it, but it's strictly off-the-record information. So that's not necessarily information I shouldn't have, but it is information that I can't share publicly. So no, I've never seen, you know, police have never given me a file and I've looked at it and thought, oh my God, I shouldn't have this. So that doesn't really happen to me. I do know some people it's happened to. Mistakes are made occasionally, but I haven't been subjected to it yet. Medea Shoot asks, when are you back? Trace Evidence will resume its normal schedule on Monday, January 7th. So only a little bit longer to go. I appreciate everybody's patience. Normally, I take the month of December off. This year, particularly in the last half of it, was really rough in terms of medical issues that came up for me and just personal life stuff and work stuff. So it interfered with my schedule a little bit more than I wanted it to this year. I don't know what happened. I don't normally get sick that much. But this year I got sick a lot, and at the moment, I'm actually in a lot of pain because I'm having incredibly difficult sciatica. And I've had it before, but it was usually just discomfort. This time it was so bad that I couldn't walk for a couple of days here. So I'm hoping 2019 is going to be a year of much better times for me. But I've also been taking this break, which isn't really a break. I've been working on episodes for 2019, so I'm hoping to create enough of a backlog that should something come up in the future and I can't record that week, I'll have an episode that I can put out. Marcellus Torres asks, out of all the cases you remember covering, is there one case that has perplexed you the most? A lot of the cases I've covered are really perplexing. The one that came to mind when I read this question was April Pitzer. I think we have a pretty good idea of what happened there, but just the events that led up to what happened and all the people involved with that case who probably knew what happened or were involved with it directly, not sharing the information that they had and many of them going to their graves without sharing that information drives me kind of crazy. So the disappearance of April Pitzer is a case that just absolutely drives me crazy. And every time I look at it, it bothers me more. That's a heartbreaking story as it is. Just imagining April's poor mother out there crawling around in these mine shafts trying to find her daughter, it's really disturbing, and I sincerely hope that we get some answers on that. Sam asks, do you have a pod crush? I have playful pod crushes. I don't have anything serious, but just off the top of my head, Olivia from Something's Not Right. She's one of the nicest people that I've ever met through podcasting. The two ladies from Corpus Delecti, one of them is really sweet and really nice and really funny, and the other one's really evil and mean, and I love them both equally, and I'll let them figure out which one I'm talking about with each of those descriptions. Laura from The Fall Line, which I wouldn't call a pod crush. I look at her more like an older sister, but she's awesome and amazing and has been really helpful with me. So yeah, there's several people out there who are quote unquote pod crushes. The final question comes from Bart Coleman. I would like to see a Kurt Cobain episode. There is truly some mysterious circumstances surrounding that case. I really think you'd do a great job of researching the facts and was fascinated by the George Reeves episode. What are your thoughts on that idea? I can answer this question really simply. You will get a Kurt Cobain episode in 2019. I've already been working on it. I've been working on it for a long time. I actually had planned to release it in 2018, but things got in the way and I wanted further information. So I assure you, you're getting a Kurt Cobain episode. I love answering questions from all of you, and I want to thank you not only for submitting questions, but for all your support. Trace Evidence wouldn't exist without all of you, and I'm incredibly grateful to every person who listens to even a single episode of Trace Evidence. 2018 was a year of challenges, but also a year of growth and experience. We saw some cases solved, we saw some cases receive new tips and developments. I really would love to be able to do more updates on cases being solved in the future. I'm hoping for 2019 to be a banner year for Trace Evidence, and I've been working on a lot of new angles and areas to take the show in the future. I'm not a huge fan of change, so the show will keep its format, and I won't be adjusting much in terms of production, but case selection and approach will expand beyond the current scope. Many of you have reached out to me, eager for the next episode, and trust me, I'm itching to get back to it myself. I'm really looking forward to being back in the swing of releasing episodes each week. Episode 66 will release on Monday, January 7th, and the show will be back on its normal schedule. Thank you all so much for your kindness and support, and I'm really looking forward to going into the new year with you. For those of you who celebrate, I want to wish you a very happy holiday season and a joyous new year. To those of you who don't, well, then I hope your days are full of joy and fun. Thank you all so much again, and I'll see you on January 7th with the next unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.